This is 4:55 on Wednesday, October 30th. Okay, good morning. So there are a lot fewer people here today than there were on Monday.
I think it's because Edwin's taking the test and they're like, oh, I don't have to click on to this semester.
Well, I don't know. My theory in 3:55 this morning was that everybody decided it was going to be a 5-day weekend. This is not true. There is class on Friday. There's class today, for that matter. All right. So, I need to make some adjustments on the schedule, obviously. It was completely unreasonable to even have thought that I would assign the assignment last Friday and have it due the following Friday for Chapter 5. To begin with, that was unreasonable. And then I didn't. So we're now at Wednesday, and having it due on Friday would just be even more unreasonable. So let's move the Chapter 5 due date down to probably Veterans Day, the 11th. Okay, so I'll do that. And Chapter 6 will probably indeed get assigned somewhere in here and be due somewhere after that. Okay, I don't know. And then I'm also thinking that I should move Project 2 due date. Because people struggle with this project, I know, and so I hope people are beginning to struggle with this project by this point. Because even if I do move it, if you're not beginning to struggle with it, then that's well, that's it's trouble down the road. So I'll move that as well, probably. I don't know. Maybe what I should do is make the Chapter 5 due on the 8th and make the project due on the Veterans Day, so you have the free day. I'll do that. Okay. That sounds like a good plan. I will get the Chapter 5 assignment questions out this afternoon, so look up here for that. We seem to be in good shape as far as making the required progress through the material, so I'm not worried about that. Did anybody talk with the ABET evaluators while they were here? Did any of you get nominated to do that? So every 6 years we have this accreditation visit from ABET. They're the agency that accredits our degrees, and they were here from Sunday through Tuesday of this week. And they've left now, and things went pretty well. I think we're in good shape. There are a few things that they want us to address, but I don't think there's anything serious there, so at least from what I've heard. So that's good news. It means your degrees are going to be worth something, you know, when you get them, which is a good thing. I'd like to see that. All right. So Dr. Gamage was here for the last two lectures. He covered up through section 5.3, he said. Is everybody comfortable with the CRC calculation process? Have you looked again at that? You will be by the time you get through the homework, all right? So the thing to remember is that the division is done with sort of this mod 2 or XOR type addition and subtraction, and I think if you keep that in mind, everything seems pretty sensible, but that's one thing. Anything else that he talked about that has question, that you have questions about? Oh, the other thing you probably have a question about is, when do we get our exams back? It will be Monday before I get to that, because I still have to get the 3:55 one done. So, we are then ready to talk about local area networks and the link layers. All right. So, we've talked a lot about IP addressing, right? We've talked about 4-byte addresses for IP version 4 and 8-byte addresses for IP version 6. But that only gets us to the local area network, right? Those subnet addresses and so forth, and the routing that we've talked about for IP, take datagrams and take them from their source to the router at the gateway of the destination network. And now, how do we get those datagrams from a machine that's already on a particular local area network to some other machine on the same network? That's the question here. And the answer lies in what's called MAC addresses. It stands for, MAC here stands for Media Access Control, but that makes no sense. That's just what they're called. The words don't mean anything particular. We sometimes call them LAN addresses, physical addresses, Ethernet addresses. And the idea of these addresses is that they are local to the link layer. They never go off of the link layer. Nobody outside of a particular link layer network understands them. Okay. And so they're 48 bits, and they're manufactured into network interfaces at the time that they're built. We write them in hex these days, and sometimes we put in colons instead of dashes, and sometimes we make them be lowercase instead of uppercase hex digits. If you turn your computer over and look at the bottom of it, you will probably see a label that has on it the MAC address of your interfaces. Let's see if that's true for mine. Yes, I have one that labels, that has the MAC address for the Ethernet port and one for the wireless LAN port. Yeah. Not case sensitive. No, these are hexadecimal numbers, hexadecimal digits, I should say. Not case sensitive. Always 6 bytes. And unique, manufactured differently for everyone. Well, they're supposed to be unique. There are occasions when I was working at Xerox, we occasionally got machines that had the same MAC address on them. That's not a good thing. If they're on different subnets, they're okay. But if they're on the same subnet, they can cause trouble. And if you play around with your home router, right, that connects you to your ISP, often within the settings there, you will find a setting that allows you to change the MAC address on one of the ports, the one that talks to your ISP, because some ISPs register their customers according to the MAC address of their router, and then you go buy a new router, and you come home from the store and you're so proud of it and you want it to go to work immediately, but the ISP is not around to answer the phone for the change. So you can change your MAC address sometimes, but they're always manufactured in a unique way, so you can change it to something that you had before sometimes. Okay, and it's associated with the adapter, which these days on laptops is usually built on the motherboard for the wired networks. How do you get one? The manufacturers buy them in bulk from the IEEE. This idea of buying numbers is kind of a strange one, but that's what you have to do. You have to buy a portion of the space, and then sort of sequentially within their manufacturers things into their chips. So This is a worldwide flat address space, right? They're 48-bit numbers. 48 bits is 16K times 4 billion is 64 trillion addresses. So there's very little likelihood that we'll run out of them, except for the fragmentation caused by selling blocks to individual manufacturers. But this one doesn't seem to be in any danger like the IP address space was. So because they're unique, you can put them on any network. That causes no trouble. But they're not useful for global routing at all. So the question is then, how do we get from an IP address to at the gateway to a network to the LAN address that we need to get the last hop? Or similarly, if we just have multiple machines on the same local area network, how do they find out each other's LAN addresses? And the protocol for that is known as ARP. ARP stands for Address Resolution Protocol. And its job is to let a machine, say this one here, figure out the MAC address that corresponds to another machine's IP address on the same network. And it's very simple, it's very elegant, and it's very slick. Every machine has at all times a table called the ARP table that contains IP addresses, MAC addresses, and something called the time to live, which is how long they're willing to believe that without asking again the question, what's the association? So you build that table, and okay, so internet addresses, MAC addresses, and static just means that it's not filled in dynamically. So these 224 addresses here are multicast addresses. We didn't talk about IP multicast very much, but that's what they are. And 254 here is 47.254 is the router on this network. So when my machine wants to talk to a router, it will use that MAC address. And all ones MAC address is for broadcast. Okay, so that's what's there. And notice it didn't show me the time to live on that. Is there a way to ask it the time to live? There's the ability to use the ARP command to manually change the ARP table. Oh, let's try that. Verbose. Still doesn't tell me about time to live. Oh well. Okay, so that's within the ARP table. How does it get there? Well, that's where the ARP protocol comes into play. And like I said, it's very simple. This is the sort of coolest protocol in some sense because it's so simple. So you want to send to somebody's particular IP address. From your network configuration, you know that IP address is on the local area network on which you're attached, right? Because you can look at that address and use the net mask to figure out whether the two are on the same network, like we did for the exam, and you decide it is on the same network, then what do you have to do? You have to send it directly to that other host, but you don't know its LAN address. So you broadcast an ARP query packet. So that's the first kind of packet in this protocol. It's a broadcast packet that says who has, that's how it gets interpreted when you run Wireshark, who has the particular IP address. And we'll look at a Wireshark thing that shows this here in a second. It's broadcast. All of the nodes receive it. All the nodes process it. And the one that has that particular desired IP address comes back and replies and says, I am that IP address, including the MAC address. Well, the MAC address is sent as part of the LAN protocol anyway. So after this, A knows B's MAC address, and it turns out that B also knows A's MAC address, which is a good thing, because if A wants to talk to B, the next thing that's going to happen is B wants to talk to A, usually with a reply of some kind. So that's good. And so it's all just completely transparent. Nobody configures anything for this to work. It's just...
And B knows A's MAC address because A sends in that original
query. A sends it in that original query. Yeah. So let's see what this looks like. Okay, so this is what the ARP stuff looks like. It turns out that there's some stuff in here that just says what kind of hardware are we talking about, in this case Ethernet, what upper level protocol, IP, because ARP works not only for IP, but IP version 6 and a bunch of other protocols as well at the upper layer. Hardware address size is 6. 6-byte MAC addresses, 4-byte IP addresses, who has type 1, and sender MAC address is here, sender IP address is here, target IP address is here, but the target MAC address is missing. And so the target comes back and says, here I am. Except that it reverses the send. Yeah, it now is the sender. So the sender is advertising its IP address. But the recipient is also in there. So very slick. Just no problem at all to do this. Okay, if a IP address is on a different subnet, then routers have to get involved. We've already talked about that in Chapter 4, but routers play along with this ARP protocol as well. After all, routers have IP addresses on their interface. That's how you send to them as a client. And so if this guy needs to send to somebody over here, the first thing he has to do is do an ARP lookup for the router. Does that. The router may have to do a ARP lookup for another router or not, and similarly for the end. So there may be several ARP lookups that occur. They're all quite fast, right? Because all they are is a single packet sent with a broadcast and a single reply. You want to have this caching behavior where the time to live happens because you just want to take the load off of the network mainly. That's the main thing. But it also saves a round trip time on the LAN each time. Okay, so fancy. I don't know that this one is worth this fancy animation, but whatever. Okay. That was slick. Okay. Whatever. All right. So now let's talk about Ethernet. So Ethernet is the really the granddaddy of the local area networking movement, if you will. It was created at Xerox in around 1975, I think. And we've got a picture coming up here of it. By a guy named Bob Metcalf, who went on to found the company 3Com. It was standardized by Digital Equipment Corporation, which was a major computer vendor at the time, Xerox, which was office equipment, and Intel, which was a manufacturer of chips. And so you often see this called the DICS, standard for Digital, Intel, and Xerox. excuse me. And Metcalf's idea was very simple. He said, what if we had a wire that ran all around an office area, and we could plug into that the computers that are also in the office area, and they could communicate with each other. That's sort of the gist of the idea. And his idea about how to have that wire work was that it would be a coaxial cable, and his original design was based on sort of what's called thick coax. It's about somewhere between 3/8 of an inch and a 1/2 inch in diameter. Okay, and I got some good stories about this. So it was thick coax. How are you going to attach the host to that coax? Well, this tap thing here is sometimes also known as a vampire tap, because it's got a sharp point that is insulated most of the way down, and it actually pokes through the skin of the coax cable and goes through the outer shield and through the inner conductor and hits the inside conductor of the coax, and then there's another connector that connects to the shield. And so this thing actually makes a hole in the cable in order to connect to it. And of course, that's very easy because it means you don't have to build complicated connections in this thick coax cable. There's some electronics here right by the vampire tap that does the electronics part of sending the signal. And the protocol here is CSMA with collision detection, like you talked about last time. And that's actually handled up here by this interface thing that also interfaces to the computer. And so you can have, I don't know, 250 of these computers attached to this in a length of about 300 meters, I think, are the specifications. Which has to do with electrical stuff and matching impedances and other things. So, pretty slick, 1975. And they started building these and putting them on the computers that Xerox was building at the time. And they ran this networking throughout the building. Okay, so I worked in this building. And I worked in this building starting about 10 years later until about 25 years later. And so by the time I left, this stuff was 25 years old. Okay, what happens when you have holes in coaxial cables with little bits of metal poking through them? Corrosion. Okay? So this stuff gets corroded, and then it doesn't work very well. It gets jiggled, and then you make short circuits, and all of this cable is up in the ceiling or under the raised floor, and it's not fun. Okay, so but we had this up until about 1996, I guess. So 20 years later, maybe even a little longer. So that was the original Ethernet. The speed at which he did it was 3 megabits a second, I think. Xerox used these Ethernets inside their big copy machines at the time to do communication between the microprocessors that control different pieces of the copy machine, as well as in the office environment. IBM looked at this and said, "Oh, this is a terrible design. This CSMA CD stuff is awful. It doesn't get very good utilization of the network." Did I tell you this story before? And so IBM said, "We need a better architecture for our networks than this." And so they built something called Token Ring LANs, or started to build something called Token Ring LANs. But they didn't really get started until about 5 or 6 or even 7 years after this was started. And what they came up with was a lot more complicated, a lot more expensive, 7 years behind in the market. And so the only market for those token ring LANs ended up being people who were sort of dyed-in-the-wool IBM customers anyway. Because the cabling was more expensive, the interfaces were more expensive, but it was IBM, and you couldn't ever be fired for buying IBM. Ethernet won, and it won in a big way, and it won by evolving away from this particular implementation to a number of different things that all use the same basic communication ideas, but different implementations in terms of the hardware. So commercially, it started out of being 10 megabits per second. These days, even 100 gigabit per second Ethernet is available. So how did Ethernet evolve to get away from this awful vampire tap idea? So the first thing that happened was that it got redesigned to run over what was called ThinNet. And with ThinNet, you actually had a Ethernet cable that was only a quarter inch in diameter, and putting connectors on it was easy. And so there would be a separate chunk of cable with connectors going between each host. Okay, and then there were T connections that the interfaces would plug into. No more punching holes in wires. But still, running around throughout the building, these big chunks of coax that sort of looped around all the offices in order to connect everything. And that was not the way that buildings had been built up to that time. So adding Ethernet of that kind to a building was a very expensive proposition, except at the time that the building was first being built. So then somebody comes along and says, "You know, this is silly. We need to build a networking technology that takes advantage of the stuff that's already in buildings." What's already in buildings? Telephone wires. And telephone wires, the way buildings were built, you know, there's a wire in your office and it goes to what's called a telephone closet. And in the telephone closet, all the wires come together for a floor, say, or a part of a floor. And they're hooked into other wires that go down to the main place where telephone service comes into the building. And typically when people built office buildings, they built them with lots of telephone wire in them, because any office might belong to an administrative assistant or somebody who needed to answer all the phone lines for all the people on the floor, and so all there'd be lots of wire there so that a phone could have all those circuits on it. Remember, this was before the days of virtual circuits and electronics and voice over IP or anything like that. You really had to have a wire for every line. And so there was lots of wire in these buildings. It wasn't being used. And the people who did Ethernet over this said, okay, we'll just use the telephone wires that are already there. And once you do that, you have a place, the closet, to put what's called a hub or a switch. And you can attach all of the wires from all the offices in one central place, and that's a star topology. And they did that, and they found that they could run 10 megabit Ethernet over ordinary telephone wires. And we'll talk about this switched architecture here in a second. Okay, well, ordinary telephone wires are actually not very great for data. And as new buildings got built and old buildings got refurbished, they put in higher quality wire. And with higher quality wire, you can run 100 megabit per second Ethernet and even gigabit per second Ethernet. So that's sort of been the trend for wired Ethernet over all these, what are we talking about, 40 years now that this has been going on. Oh, yeah, we'll talk about switches later. Are there any questions about this? It's kind of cool. I think it's interesting how this has survived over all these years. Okay, so what happens on an Ethernet in terms of our protocol stuff? Well, we're talking about link layer protocols. What do you do when you move down a layer of the protocol stack? Slap on another header. That's the usual thing. And in the case of Ethernet, they also slapped on a trailer. They'd carry a CRC field, checksum. But that's really all we do. We put on an Ethernet header. It has something electrical here called the preamble that helps sync up the clocks. And this is going to vary depending on the particular technology. But then comes an Ethernet destination address, 6 bytes, an Ethernet source address, a type that tells the receiver what kind of data is carried in here. And that's it. Right. So, very simple. And the behavior of Ethernet adapters is to match their own address against the destination address in the packet. And if it belongs to them, either as a broadcast address or their own address, or we'll probably not talk about it, a multicast address that they're interested in, they pass it up to the higher level that comes out of the type field. So that's really all there is to it. So the beauty here is that all this is completely connectionless, right? We've got ARP that just works. We've got the ability to plug in a machine on the network, not have to configure it at all for the link layer. We have to configure the network layer, but not the link layer. It's well matched to the IP service model because it doesn't do anything about handshaking to make sure that data is received. It doesn't do anything about connections. It's just, you know, you plug it in, you start sending data. If things are dropped, you have to recover at the higher level. And CSMA CD, we said that. How has it evolved? Little bits of variation in the link layer. Not much. Mostly the evolution takes place in the physical layer. Well, there's more pictures here. There's twisted pair stuff. There's fiber optics. It has different ways to do this. Coaxial cable, I don't think I've seen a coaxial cable Ethernet for 20 years. Okay. I still see boxes, little routers and switches and things that are capable of doing coaxial cable Ethernet. Not new ones, but sitting around in labs and the like. But I don't think I've actually seen a network operating that way for a long time. So the fastest coaxial cable that I know about is 10 megabits a second. Right, so the never went beyond the original rate. Things were much more commercially viable with the twisted pair type wiring and the star topology.
Technically, it could go quite a bit higher because they kind of use similar technology between modems and ISPs.
Yeah, technically the coaxial cable ought to be easier to deal with than, sort of signaling wise, it ought to be easier to deal with than the twisted pair is. Okay, so we've seen, I have to go back here, sorry. So we've seen that the thing that's put in the middle of these star topology networks is called a switch. And now I want to talk about what goes on inside those switches. I'm completely lost. How did I get all the way back there? Got way farther backwards than I wanted to be. Yeah. Okay. Switches. There we go. So the idea of a switch is sort of like a router, but at the link layer instead of at the network layer. And by being at the link layer, that means that there aren't any subnets or anything like that. We just have the MAC addresses to worry about. And so a link layer switch takes in an Ethernet frame. It looks at the incoming and outgoing MAC addresses and decides which ports of the switch, port or ports of the switch, to forward that packet on. Okay? Easy enough. And once it has decided, then it uses the CSMA/CD process to access the outgoing link. Okay? So, once again, the guys who built this stuff were brilliant because they figured out how to do this in such a way that there's absolutely no configuration required. When you get an Ethernet switch and you have a bunch of hosts, you just plug in the host. That's all you do. And it's hard to think of there being anything easier than that except doing wireless, you know. Okay? So there's no configuration at all that's needed on these switches, at least in the basic case. These days, it's usually the case that there's one host attached to each port on the switch. But because the switch actually is capable of doing CSMA/CD on a link, it's possible for there to be multiple hosts there. It won't work as well, but the switch is supported. So a switch receives a packet, looks at it, holds on to it until it can send it out on the outgoing link. That's all it does. These days, because it's typically one host per link, and because these days we are actually using multiple wires within the cable, multiple twisted pairs, for the communication over a particular link, it's possible to allocate transmitting on some of the pairs for this end and transmitting for some of the pairs on that end. That guarantees that there are never ever any collisions. Okay? And that's called having a full duplex link. And in a full duplex network, you can be sending at 100 megabits per second and receiving at 100 megabits per second at the same time, going full rate. And so, depending now on the speed of the electronics within the switch, you can... There's a picture. No picture. Depending on the speed of the electronics within the switch, you can be having multiple full rate conversations going on through the switch at the same time. And that sort of gets back to that discussion we had before about what's in a router or a switch. Is it implemented with a bus? Is it implemented with a processor? Or is it implemented with a crossbar switch? Usually, I think the low-end ones are sort of processor-based. They don't go all that fast. A modest office-scale switch would be bus-based, largely. And an enterprise switch might be crossbar based because the cost there goes up. All right, so how does the switch figure out what's attached where? Remember, we said there's no configuration required. But when A is sending to A prime, it's putting A prime's MAC address in the packets. How does the switch know that A prime is actually attached to port number 4? Well, it learns. How does it learn? Remember that whenever A sends a packet on Ethernet, the source part of the Ethernet address is part of that packet. So the switch, when it sees any packets coming from A, say, oh, A is on port number 1. Okay? And it just records that fact. So that if somebody else comes along and says, I want to send to A, now knows where A is. And so it builds up a table of what exists on each port. Exciting. Okay. Now, actually, DHCP has been a boon for these switches, these switch networks, even though DHCP isn't really involved in these. If you have a network built on statically configured machines, so machines in which the IP address has been statically configured, you can plug them into the network and absolutely nothing will happen, right? They don't have to say anything in order to come onto the network. They know their address, they know what they're doing, and the problem with that in a switched Ethernet is that the switch may not learn their MAC address because they're so silent. Okay. So a DHCP-based system, a host coming onto the network, the voltage comes up and says, I'm on the network. I send a packet immediately to say, what's my IP address? That's enough for the switch to learn. But statically configured hosts can be silent. So this is sometimes an issue. I think these days network administrators, operating system builders have sort of learned that coming on the network is a good time to say hello and make your presence known. Okay, so the rule is when you get an incoming packet, you write down the address of the sending host. It goes into the MAC table. That's one way you learn it. You look up the destination address, and if you find it, if it's on the same segment from which the packet came, this is that limited flooding thing. Remember, you don't want to be sending something back out if it came on the same link. So you just drop it. If it's there, you can forward it. And if it is not there, then you don't know where that host is. You have to flood in order to find it. And you do that. Or if it's a broadcast frame. Broadcast frames are sent to all. So you learn sun flooding. When he sends back, then you know where it's going and you selectively send it. It's very clever. Okay. You can cascade switches. Switch 4 here now needs to learn that there are a whole bunch of MAC addresses on this port. It can do that. That's fine. No problem. Etc. Okay, I think we'll stop there. Next time we'll cover how this sort of cascades to, or how this builds up in larger systems, and then talk about what am I going to talk about? Oh, mobile? No. Oh, VLANs. Yeah, okay, VLANs. That's right. Virtual LANs. Virtual local area networks. So we'll do that next time. Any questions at this point? Okay. Cool stuff. If you unplug it, no, typically not.
They just
forget everything. Come back, learn what they need to learn again.
Okay. So if all the network's down and the switch back up, it's gonna take a while.
A few seconds. Not long. All this stuff happens at a great rate these days.
Thank you.